90.1 FM wishes you a bright winter solstice.
We all know about Dr. King's speech, "I Have a Dream." But when he went down by the riverside to a church in New York City in 1967 and denounced what he called the madness of militarism, that's a no-go for corporate media, the politicians, the Democrats and Republicans who embrace his memory have that part of his legacy down the Orwellian vacuum tube. Dr. King said, quote, "I must honestly say to you that I never intend to adjust myself to the madness of militarism."
That's Norman Solomon, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Norman Solomon on the madness of militarism. Many are familiar with Eisenhower's 1961 warning of the military-industrial complex. Veteran CIA analyst Ray McGovern has expanded on Ike's phrase. He coined the term Mickey Matt, the military-industrial congressional intelligence media academia think tank complex. How does it work? The notorious revolving door syndrome links the Pentagon to the arms manufacturers to Congress. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin is a perfect example. Before being appointed by Biden, he was on the board of Raytheon, a giant weapons corporation. Conflict of interest, you might say? Nah. And don't forget, no one wants to be labeled soft on defense. Corporations bankroll politicians of both parties, who then okay arms purchases. There's tons of money to be made in cost overruns and repairing defective equipment. Just look at Zumwalt destroyers or the F-35. What a boondoggle. Military madness continues apace. Our guest today is Norman Solomon. He's a leading independent political commentator and media critic. He's the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and co-founder of RootsAction.org, an online activist group. He's the author of many books. His latest is War Made Invisible. He gave the second annual Daniel Ellsberg Lecture at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst in mid-November. And now, Norman Solomon.
One day in 1995, I called Daniel Ellsberg and suggested that he run for president. And his response was instantaneous. He said, "I'd rather be in prison." And when I asked why, he was very quick and very clear to explain. He said, "I can't think of how awful it would be to keep talking about things I don't know much about." It doesn't seem to stop many candidates for president, but for Dan, that was a no-go. And I thought about that conversation many times, and it's often made me go back to an essential question: what did Dan Ellsberg know? He knew from the inside of the U.S. war machine what almost no one who had reached his level of that apparatus was willing to talk about publicly. In my own words, what he knew, and most importantly, what he was willing to share with the public, was that the leaders of the so-called Defense Department and the State Department and people in the Oval Office not only could lie, but did lie frequently without regard for truth and without regard for human life. That realization and that willingness to share that truth is as current at the end of 2023 and as crucial as it was in 1971 when the Pentagon Papers were released. A couple of years ago, when I talked with Dan Ellsberg with the recorder going, This is what he said, that there is deception, that the public is evidently misled by it early in the game, in the approach to war, in a way that encourages them to accept a war and support a war, is the reality. How much of a role does the media actually play in this, in deceiving the public? And how difficult is it to deceive the public? I would say, as a former insider, one becomes aware it's not difficult to deceive them. First of all, you're often telling them what they would like to believe, that we're better than other people. We are superior in our morality and our perceptions of the world. In a book that is as important as any that I've ever read, The Doomsday Machine, Dan starts with an epigraph from Friedrich Nietzsche. It goes as follows. Madness in individuals is something rare, but in groups, parties, nations, and epochs, it is the rule. Think of that often in tandem with what Martin Luther King Jr. described as the madness of militarism as real in our day as when he uttered those words in 1967. Dr. King spoke about what he called the destructive demonic suction tube that drew tremendous quantities of resources away from this country, from human well-being, from healthcare, education, housing, infant care, elderly care, you name it. Walk around Massachusetts or California or any other state, and you won't be far from the deficits as a result, in large measure, of that demonic, destructive suction tube. George Orwell wrote about how sloppy thinking can corrupt language, and language can corrupt thought, and we're immersed in that kind of corrosion and that kind of corruption. We hear and we routinely use terms like defense spending and defense budget, and I'll grant you that there's an uppercase thing called Defense Department, but we see it, we read it, we use it as though that's a lowercase word, defense. A country that spends more on military expenditures than the next 9 nations on the planet combined, and most of those countries are U.S. allies. A country with 750 military bases overseas, with a huge military apparatus, and we're encouraged to believe that all this is going to something called defense. I spent a couple of years working on a book called War Made Invisible. And one of the key resonant truths that came to me anyway, and that I tried to reflect in the writing, is that we have come to be acclimated to seeing the world, experiencing the world, most importantly, hearing it described and depicted by elected officials and media with 2 tiers of grief. The entire planet divided into people whose lives really matter and people whose lives don't. We may not see it that way conceptually, but we're encouraged to see it that way day after day after day. Lives that really matter and lives don't. And the corrosion of our country, our governance, our media, and even ourselves results. Quick survey. Anyone here in your neighborhood, in your community, in your travels in the United States in the last year or two, you ever seen a flag of the nation of Ukraine? Please raise your hand. Ukrainian flag, anybody? Wow, almost the whole room, almost everybody here has seen the display in solidarity and with the humanity of Ukrainian people who are suffering a horrific invasion, warfare imposed on them by another country. A really appropriate display of solidarity and compassion. Here's the other part of my survey. Please raise your hand if you've seen displayed in your neighborhood or your walk of life, your community, your travels in the United States, the display of a flag of the country of Yemen. Not seeing a single hand, and I can't raise my hand either. Every day, when I go shopping or go to work in my little office, I see the flags of Ukraine. I don't see any Yemeni flags. You may remember the fist bump in the middle of 2022 when President Biden went and met with the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia. That kind of solidarity between a country that has sold billions of dollars worth of weapons, provided intelligence to help Saudi Arabia as it slaughters civilians in Yemen. The Media Watch Group FAIR did a study of MSNBC. You know, that's the liberal network, right? It's not Fox. And found almost no coverage whatsoever of the slaughter going on in Yemen. As a matter of fact, this was during the Trump administration, 5,000% as much coverage of the Russiagate scandal, the Russiagate narrative, than what was happening in Yemen. And people might say, well, gee, that's in spite of the fact that ever since 2015, the U.S. government has been supporting the killing from the air and the massacres by Saudi Arabia of people in Yemen. We might think, well, that's in spite. Well, that's odd. The United States government's directly involved. That's in spite of that involvement. We don't have U.S. media hardly paying any attention to it at all. And then with the invasion of Ukraine, huge coverage, empathetic coverage, appropriate coverage of the suffering on the ground in Ukraine. But that was a different tier of grief that's officially sanctified and encouraged. So in Yemen, when children were dying en masse, when the largest cholera epidemic in modern history was taking place courtesy of the Saudi regime with the support of the United States, not newsworthy. So then we might do another comparison. We could do a comparison between two invasions. The invasion of Ukraine, crime against humanity, terrible killing, mostly from the air, the mortars and the rockets and all the rest of it, the invading forces of Russia, that terrible invasion. And the invasion a couple of decades earlier of Iraq. Well, the Media Watch Group FAIR did a study and found during a comparable period, the beginning of those invasions, there were 14 front page prominent articles about the suffering of Ukrainian people. 14. And during the comparable period, there was one on the same outlet's front page of the New York Times about the suffering of Iraqi people. 14-1. Two invasions, two very different kinds of coverage. And as a matter of fact, I think the U.S. mass media coverage, if you set aside the political spin, which was huge, well, they didn't talk about the role of NATO expanding to Russia's border, on and on and on. But when you talk about, when you look at the actual content of the coverage of U.S. news media, of the suffering of Ukrainian people, it's been exemplary. Corporate media in the United States can convey the real suffering from war if it's inflicted by an official enemy of the United States. But on the other hand, if it's being inflicted by the United States, occasional human interest stories that don't last very long, don't hit the echo chamber, don't have much political effect. This is what is part of what we're told is the rules-based order. You may have heard that phrase from President Biden. You might have heard that phrase from Secretary of State Antony Blinken. We have to have a rules-based order. We can't have chaos. We can't have countries going around invading each other. This became a very popular official phrase in Washington after the invasion of Ukraine. It's a little odd coming from the mouths of Antony Blinken and Joe Biden, because if you flash back to the summer of 2002, Antony Blinken was the chief of staff, and Joe Biden was the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee when they helped greenlight the invasion of Iraq, with bogus hearings in the summer of 2002, not allowing skeptics to even testify, and ginning up the momentum for Congress to, months later, approve the invasion of Iraq. So it makes you kind of wonder, what does rules-based order really mean? And it sort of means, it does mean, we make the rules, we break the rules. That's what it really means. It really means, do as we say, not as we do. It really means might makes right is our guiding star. That is our North Star, the United States of America. You may remember in 1999, President Clinton, when the U.S. led the NATO bombing of Kosovo and Yugoslavia, we saw the news magazines with the cover stories and the TV accounts and the footage. Ethnic cleansing. We can't allow ethnic cleansing. That's not the American way. Our values require us to stand firm against ethnic cleansing. President Bill Clinton made a speech, and I'm quoting here. He said, we must adhere to, quote, the moral imperative of reversing ethnic cleansing, unquote. What's happening right now in Gaza? To call it ethnic cleansing is perhaps too mild a term. We can have an academic or journalistic discussion about whether it's genocide or it's sociocide, but it's mass murder. That's what's going on. Ethnic cleansing, 1999, moral imperative to reverse it. 2023, out of the same Oval Office, get those terrorists. It's unfortunate. Civilians are dying. We will hope that our Israeli allies will not kill so many civilians. That's the message. The U.S. government now rushing through another $14 billion with a B dollars of military aid to Israel as the deaths continue in Gaza. After several weeks of intensive bombing of Gaza, a total of 18 members of the U.S. House of Representatives were willing to co-sponsor a ceasefire resolution. 18 out of 435. We're not talking deep red states here. Let's talk about California. One of the House members from California signed on as a co-sponsor of a resolution urging a ceasefire in Gaza. In Massachusetts, one member of the U.S. House willing to sign that resolution. Maybe it's significant, maybe it isn't. You be the judge. Every one of those 18 House members who became, were willing to become a co-sponsor of the ceasefire resolution, every single one of them are people of color. Not a single white member of the House of Representatives willing to co-sponsor that resolution. Back in late October, the Save the Children organization had reported, I'm quoting here, the number of children reported killed in Gaza in just 3 weeks has surpassed the annual number of children killed across the world's conflict zones since 2019. On November 10th, the Director General of the World Health Organization told the United Nations Security Council, quote, on average, a child is killed every 10 minutes in Gaza. Courtesy, I would add, of U.S. taxpayers. And if you do the math, that's about 1,000 kids a week. We might think about the 96% of the U.S. House of Representatives in 2023 who've declined to co-sponsor a ceasefire resolution. What if their children were being bombed? What if their children had to be pulled out of the rubble? It's not a stretch to say that those members of the House are accomplices to mass murder. It's not a stretch to say that the President of the United States is an accomplice to mass murder, but it's virtually unsayable in U.S. mass media. And the members of Congress, the few willing to even come close to talk about genocide going on, they're withstanding ferocious attacks. No good deed of truth to go unpunished. A few weeks into the bombing of Gaza, there were reliable reports that 180 doctors and nurses had been killed in Gaza. We've had reports of healthcare practitioners in Gaza, in what's left of hospitals, seeing their own families brought in dead on gurneys. That's part of U.S. foreign policy. The poet William Stafford wrote, "I call it cruel, and maybe the root of all cruelty, to know what occurs, but not recognize the fact." Sometimes to recognize the fact is just too painful, too difficult, too inconvenient. During the first 5 weeks of the bombing of Gaza, more than 11,000 civilians were killed, including nearly 5,000 children. This in response to the atrocities that Hamas committed on October 7th in Israel, where the latest estimate of the death toll is 1,200, including at least 846 civilians, and also about 200 hostages were taken. We so desperately need in our media, in our politics, in our discourse, a single standard of human rights, of international law, no matter who is committing the atrocities, no matter who is engaging in terrorism. It's really fascinating in an Orwellian analytical sense to see how routinely Hamas is described as a terrorist organization. And it is. And how we can't find, I can't find a single instance where the U.S. mass media, any one of the outlets, has described the Israeli government as a terrorist organization. But if we have the same standard, that would be appropriate. And then what do we say about the biggest accomplice to that terrorist organization called the Israeli government? That would be the United States government. What does it mean when you're an active accomplice? You know, they're busting gun dealers for selling assault rifles to somebody who shoots up a supermarket or a school. Those people are prosecuted. But 400 and more members of the House of Representatives, the guy behind the office desk in the Oval Office, dare not even say that they have an accomplished role. That's a bridge too far. That's not allowed. We have to mind our P's and Q's. Because terrorism is defined as is convenient. And so when the U.S. government, and it's very good at this, kills from the air, we're above it all. That's not terrorism. It's a 180 we're made to understand from packing a bunch of explosives in the trunk of a car and driving it into a target. Something that I've wrestled with a lot and wrote about in War Made Invisible is that question of intentionality. That's part of the conceit in the United States, in Israel, and elsewhere. Oh, we don't target civilians, unlike those bad terrorists. We don't target civilians. And yet, throughout the so-called war on terror and now what's going on in Gaza, the effect is absolutely the same because the civilian deaths are absolutely predictable. And the people giving the orders at the top know that. But it's a sort of a shell game pretense. Oh, we don't target them. No, we kill them. We know we will kill all those civilians, so many, but that's okay. We've given ourselves an out. And the mass media, of course, go along with that. That's fine. There's a lot of talk these days, of course, about we shouldn't make students uncomfortable. I'm not just talking Florida here. I'm talking every state in this country. We have people saying, sometimes in very high places, positions of authority, mass media, civic groups saying, we must not make students uncomfortable. They shouldn't have to hear things that make them uncomfortable. And then, of course, we could think, I wonder how comfortable students have been in Gaza for the last few weeks, when our own country is directly involved, directly complicit, but we shouldn't make anybody uncomfortable by sharing information about it, showing some of the results. The problem is not people being too uncomfortable. The problem is people being too comfortable and encouraged to be too comfortable. Whether it's the U.S. warfare state, whether it's corporate power, whether it's the grievous inequities of wealth and terrible poverty and the systemic racism. Comfort? That we're supposed to be comfortable? We're supposed to adjust ourselves to that? The whole mentality that is officially promulgated and encouraged is that when the United States does things that aren't quite right, that's an anomaly. It's not systemic. Oh, it's just an anomaly. The mistakes are made. But actually, the mistakes are systemic because they're not mistakes. The atrocities become routine. They become built in because they are organized that way. Aldous Huxley said, the propagandist's purpose is to make one set of people forget that certain other sets of people are human. That's the unspoken messaging that is so much a part of these two tiers of grief. On the planet, the United States has 4% of the world's population. And yet, with the window on the world tinted red, white, and blue, we're encouraged to believe that, hey, it's about us. It's really about us. The anomalies, we're encouraged to believe, that's not who we are. Maybe it is, but part of who we are is to tell each other that that's not who we are. Soon after the U.S. military slaughtered huge numbers of people in the Philippines, the American author William Dean Howells wrote a short story. It was called Editha. And in that short story, one of the characters says, what a thing it is to have a country that can't be wrong, but if it is right anyway. I can't think of a more contemporary comment than one that was written more than a century ago. And coming along with that is the absence of remorse. It's really stunning. You know, I'm in my early 70s, so I've been alive during the going on from the Vietnam War. Keep looking for remorse. 3 million Vietnamese people, the slaughter in Laos and Cambodia, illegal, immoral. People being killed in the Plain of Jars in Laos who had never even heard of the United States. Where was the remorse, and where is the remorse?
You're listening to Norman Solomon on the Madness of Militarism. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program and his book, War Made Invisible, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Well, there's not enough time to do justice to the war since then. Grenada, Panama in the 1980s, 1991, according to the Pentagon, 100,000